everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's January 2023, and this is episode 323, which is a conversation about Buddhism. Today's guest is Dr. Daniel J. McCoy, who is editorial director of Renew.org. He is also the general editor of the book, The Popular Handbook of World Religions from Harvest House, and the co-author of the book, The Atheist's Fatal Flaw. Daniel has written an online exclusive article for the Christian Research Journal. His article is called, Why Do We Exist? Opposite Answers from Buddhism and Christianity. And everyone can read his article for free at our website, equip.org. We want to make this article free so that you can get an idea of some of the content that we bring you so that it's able to be viewed by everyone. Daniel, it's good to have you on.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Well, as I mentioned, Daniel has written a feature article for the Christian Research Journal, and he has a new book coming out that's called Buddhism or Christianity, Which is Better for the World, and it's being published by Moral Apologetics Press. And a fun fact about them is some of our Christian Research Journal authors, the Baguettes, are behind that, Mary Beth and David, so that's fun. But basically, their publishing company is trying to publish work that adjudicates between competing visions of reality by means of moral criteria. So Daniel's book in particular is focusing on distinctions between Christianity and Buddhism. For example, like which religion provides a more robust account of objective moral values and duties and even intrinsic human worth. And we are going to be able to unpack some of those themes on this podcast today because his article has some of the elements from his book that he has written for us. So I'm excited to talk about Buddhism in particular because it's been about 30 years since we last published a really in-depth series on Buddhism. Now, back when we did that in the 1990s, and you can find those articles on our website, equip.org, they're all by Jerry Yamamoto, we cover different kinds of Buddhism that's out there. For example, we covered Tibetan Buddhism and Theravada Buddhism and Zen Buddhism and just kind of Buddhism 101. But really, today we're just going to talk about Buddhism more generally than any specific type of Buddhism. So I want to ask Daniel, what kind of influence does Buddhism have in the world today? Because it's been 30 years since our last series of articles. I mean, is Buddhism still having an impact in the world?
Yeah, great question. Buddhism continues to be very impactful, especially in Asia, where Southeast Asia and East Asia, it's kind of the dominant religion. It's the dominant religion in a number of countries, including China and Japan. But it's increasingly a force in the Western world as well. Now, it won't show up so much in the demographic percentages. As far as the U.S., it's about 0.7% of the U.S. population. Canada's about 0.8% in Canada. But it is very much a missionary religion, as is Christianity. And it's proven very capable of kind of reinventing itself for different locations. And so in the West, I would suggest that Buddhism has become just the perfect religion for the spiritual, not religious people. Even though it is a religion, but its principles and its practices just really fit well into people who are attracted to the new spirituality, what was once called the New Age movement. And I'd say it's, as far as Eastern religions, it's definitely more attractive than Hinduism because it's not connected to the caste system, as is Hinduism. So it's really ideal for people who are spiritual but not religious. So like if you're not sure whether or not you believe in God, that's fine in Buddhism, because Buddhism doesn't even bring God really into its narrative into how the world began. Are you not a fan of taking things on faith? Well, Buddhism is said to be just all about personal experience, which leads to enlightenment, and not at all about faith or putting your faith in something. Are you not convinced that humans are in need of salvation? Well, Buddhism has no doctrine of original sin. Are you not wanting the pressure of a life-altering, all-in religious conversion. Well, Buddhism can totally be offered as kind of spiritual enhancement to bring peace into a busy life. And so because of all these factors, there's huge influx of interest in Buddhism in the West, key phrases like, you know, meditation, mindfulness. So there's a huge influence culturally, even if less so in terms of actual percentage. But in 2022, you know, it's a lot cooler to meet a Buddhist monk than a Baptist minister. And it's kind of become a real respectable religion in a post-Christian culture. So you'll see, you know, some cultural elites really grab onto Buddhism. Benedict Cumberbatch, Chris Evans, Orlando Bloom, Robert Downey Jr., George Lucas are all, you know, publicly saying that they really like Buddhist principles. So very influential culturally in the West.
You just mentioned mindfulness. And if you are a newer listener to this podcast, you might want to look up a podcast we did on mindfulness a while back. And of course, just the whole idea of meditation. And like, I think one thing about Buddhism is it's also kind of infiltrated just decor in homes. You know, it's got this like chic decor. Here's this Buddha head, or it's just very hip to have different elements, like a Zen, you know, garden where you can just meditate and rake the sand or something like that. And it's been around for a while because my oldest child is grown now. But I remember when he was maybe about 6 years old, we were going through a store and there was all these various different Buddha heads there. I guess you could buy one of those or little statues you could put in your home. And he came home and was asking me about those and wanted to know what did Buddhists believe. And I remember trying to explain to a six-year-old like the Noble Eightfold Path or something. I'm sure he didn't understand it at the time. But I wanted to ask you just generally, so what is Buddhism? You mentioned some things, but what are some of the basic tenets of Buddhism?
Yeah, so Buddhism is very, very complicated. And but I think we can get a kind of a core there in the sense of kind of telling the story of Buddhism. And so I'd like to just quickly kind of tell the story, and I'm going to use the Buddha's name as kind of an acronym. So this is helpful for me. It may be helpful for the ones listening as well. But you have, you know, you have B-U-D-D-H-A. Okay, that's the word Buddha. And what I'm going to do is take his life and kind of put it according to each of those letters. You know, that'll be the acronym. So the B and the U start with, it'll be a banquet followed by an upset stomach. Okay, so B-U, banquet followed by upset stomach. Then you have D and D, you have departure followed by discovery. So again, banquet followed by upset stomach, departure followed by discovery. And then finally the H-A, hopelessness followed by awakening. Hopelessness followed by awakening. So let me just tell his story quickly using those words. Hopefully it'll be memorable. But the banquet. So in the 6th century, roughly BC, a guy named Siddhartha Gautama was born. He was a prince, and it was prophesied that this baby would either become a great king or a great religious monk. Now, his father wanted his son to become a great king, and so he kept his son furnished with a life of luxury. And so that's the banquet, okay, followed by the upset stomach, the U. So Gautama desired to see the outside world. And so his father arranged for a chariot ride, and to make sure that his son would never become a monk, he had the city cleared of anything that would get his son thinking about anything religious. However, according to the story, the gods intervened at this time. And so on his chariot ride, Gautama thought he saw an old man, a sick man, a dead man, and a tranquil monk. And these are really just the gods disguised. But again, an old man, a sick man, a dead man, and then a tranquil monk. He wasn't supposed to see those, but it dawned on him, even though he lived in luxury at the time and privilege, he realized, even as a prince, I will someday get old. I myself will get sick. I myself will die. And so how do I find tranquility? Banquet followed by upset stomach. Then you have D&D. It'd be departure followed by discovery. So the departure. So Gautama leaves his beautiful wife and his son, which he has named Rahula, which actually means chain or fetter. It's something that fetters you to this world. He left his family to find enlightenment. He tried studying under teachers, but even though he quickly mastered their meditative techniques, he still didn't find enlightenment. He tried extreme asceticism. At one point, he's down to 1 grain of rice per day, still doesn't find enlightenment. So that's the departure. Now we have the discovery. Gotama decided to sit under a fig tree until he either found enlightenment or died of starvation. And so even though he was just tempted over and over by one of the gods, by morning he found enlightenment. Now he was the Buddha, which Buddha means awakened one. So that's departure followed by discovery. Finally, hopelessness, the H, followed by awakening, the A. Hopelessness. Gotama discovered what he put down as the Four Noble Truths. This was his great discovery as he became enlightened. And the first two of these Four Noble Truths talk about life's fundamental hopelessness. Okay, so number one, he discovered that to live is to suffer. Even if you have a good life, it is going to end in death and futility. It's going to end with another birth. It'll just be rebirth into the same process. It's a never-ending merry-go-round of what they called samsara, or the wheel of rebirths. So that's number one. That's his first discovery, is to live is to suffer. Number two, suffering is caused by desire. It's caused by clinging to things. Okay, and then finally, the A, we have hopelessness followed by awakening. And here are the last two of the Four Noble Truths. Number three, one can eliminate suffering by eliminating desire. Makes sense that if to live is to suffer and suffering is caused by desire, then the way to get rid of suffering is to get rid of all desire and stop craving things, clinging to things. And then finally, number four, his fourth noble truth is you can eliminate desire by the Noble Eightfold Path, which is eight rights. You have the right view, the right intention, the right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So that is Buddhism in a nutshell. There are different, you know, it's branched off into different types of Buddhism, but that's kind of the core story that it all goes back to.
Every now and then, we make some of our online exclusive articles to be available to everyone. And so that's what we did here with Daniel's article, Why Do We Exist? Opposite Answers from Buddhism and Christianity, which anyone can read at our website, equip.org. And as I mentioned, Daniel has a new book coming out called Buddhism or Christianity, Which is Better for the World? And it was published by Moral Apologetics Press and is available now. So head on over to our website to read his article. Now, another way you can partner with us while you're there at the website is, of course, to subscribe to our journal, which you can do there at the website. If you click journal, you'll see a tab where it says subscribe. And then also you could maybe partner with us by giving us a tip. I know that a full subscription is not always in the budget for everyone, but the link to get us a tip is available at any of the landing pages for any of the episodes. And of course, the best way to get the word out about the Postmodern Realities podcast is simply tell a friend. Let people know that you listen to this and what you like about it. And if you could go into Apple Podcasts, help us out with the algorithm online to suggest our podcast to more people. If you could go and just write a quick review about why you like to listen to the podcast, we'd be very grateful. So thanks for partnering with us, and check out Daniel's article on the website.
So you just kind of gave us an overview of the life of the Buddha. And so you said it's complex, but there are some branches of Buddhism. So what are the main branches of Buddhism?
Yeah, so I'll talk about a couple terms. The first is Theravada, which starts with TH, Theravada, and then Mahayana. And so Theravada, the oldest branch of Buddhism that is still in existence today, is called Theravada Buddhism, which means the tradition of the elders, or also called Hinayana Buddhism, Hinayana, which means the little vehicle. Okay, why would it be called the little vehicle? Well, they didn't actually call themselves that. Other people called them that. But it's because in Theravada or Hinayana, the path to enlightenment means becoming a monk, which not everyone can do. Now, in those societies that are Theravadan, you can progress toward enlightenment by helping the monks, but it just would mean that you would be reborn in an even more advantageous rebirth. But the point of Theravada would be that the monks are trying to be like the Buddha and achieve enlightenment. Okay, then along came the Mahayana, and they called themselves the great vehicle. That's what the word Mahayana means. As opposed to the little vehicle, the Hinayana, you have the Mahayana and the great vehicle. And it was the Mahayana that called the Theravadins the Hinayana. They're just the little vehicle. So Mahayana Buddhism basically expanded everything into a much bigger vehicle. They brought along a greater number of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, which is a Buddha in the making. They expanded it to a lot greater number of ways to find enlightenment. You don't have to just become a monk. There are other paths. They expanded it to an invitation to not just be like the Buddha and enter nirvana yourself, but rather an invitation to become a bodhisattva, a Buddha in the making, and save all beings. And so among the Mahayana ways to enlightenment would be Zen would be Mahayana. That's kind of an intuitive accepting of reality as it comes. You have Pure Land Buddhism, which would fall under the Mahayana, which is you're trusting in a Buddha named Amida, and he's going to help you toward enlightenment in his Pure Land. There are a number of sects within Buddhism that fall under the Mahayana category. But those are the two main branches. You have Theravada and Mahayana, the little vehicle, the big vehicle.
So I mentioned at the start of this podcast that your book, Buddhism or Christianity, Which is Better for the World, is a comparison of the highest ethic of Christianity and the highest ethic of Buddhism to figure out which one is better for people. And can you describe what the highest ethics are for both Christianity and Buddhism?
Yeah. So what I've done in the book, and this is based on my doctoral dissertation, which studied the highest ethic of Buddhism and the highest ethic of Christianity. What I'll do here is I'm going to give you two terms, and then I'm going to give you the definition that I actually use in the book, and I hope it's helpful. The two terms would be Buddhist compassion, which is the highest ethic in Buddhism, and Christian love, which would be the highest ethic in Christianity. So I'm going to go ahead and define these. I'll kind of go slowly here because there's a lot packed in these definitions, but Buddhist compassion I define as the endeavor to follow the Buddha's example of rescuing people from the seduction of an enduring reality and from the disappointment of frustrated purposefulness. I'll pause there for just a second. Basically, this is a very Mahayana definition where we're rescuing people from their ignorance and their illusions and their disappointments while remaining unattached to selves and untroubled by suffering. In other words, I'm going to have compassion on you by trying to rescue you from your plight, but I'm not going to attach myself thereby to you, and I'm going to not be troubled by your suffering. I'm going to not be attached to you. So that's Buddhist compassion. Again, a real Mahayana feel toward it, because that's the branch that really prioritizes compassion toward all beings. And then Christian love, I'll define as this. It would be the endeavor to participate in Jesus's project of restoring people to their ultimate purpose in light of God's ultimate reality, motivated by attachment to their ultimate well-being and by grief over their sins. So you really hear a difference there in terms of the highest ethic of Buddhism. Buddhist compassion is an ethic of rescue and even of escaping this reality, whereas Christian love is much more focused on restoration to an original purpose that God had in mind. I'll just mention quickly, you know, Buddhist compassion, what are they aspiring to rescue people from? And I'd like to propose four levels at which you could try to kind of rescue somebody or show compassion on somebody. Four levels, these will grow in intensity. So the base level of rescuing somebody would be to try to help them to remove their problem with the problem. Now, what does that mean? Well, if somebody has a tumor, and that tumor is making them feel sad, if I could make them not feel sad, that would be removing the problem with the problem. There's no longer, they don't have a problem with it anymore. Does that make sense? But you go higher than that. A second level would be to remove the problem from the problem. Okay. That would be if you have a tumor, we're going to remove the tumor's side effects so that, for example, you no longer get sick because of the tumor. You still have the tumor, but because I'm removing the problem from the problem. A third level, a higher level of rescuing somebody would be to remove the problem from the person. And in terms of a tumor, that would be actually removing the tumor from the person. But there's a fourth level, and this is where we're starting to enter into Buddhist compassion. Suppose that the problem is so bad that a person, that you can't really remove the problem from it because the problem is so all pervasive. Well, the fourth level would be to remove the person from the problem. And the idea, you know, in Buddhism is that all of life, all of existence is the tumor. So we're going to remove the person altogether from this tumor called existence into the extinguishing of nirvana. I think that will help. There's a little more I could say on that, but I think I'm going to stop there.
So I really want to know, you mentioned that various different celebrities and, you know, like George Lucas, he's a famous director who created Star Wars, have found Buddhism very appealing. So what is it about Buddhism's view, for example, about why people exist would be appealing to so many people?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. I would say it helps people to not stick their neck out so much, to not invest their hopes so much in something that they feel is going to disappoint. And I would say that the Buddha's, you know, great insight was that literally all of life ends in futility in its own way. I mean, stuff rots eventually. The leaders that you trust, they'll let you down. The people you love will die. The body that you count on will decay. And so, you know, the Buddha was just incredibly realistic about the problem of all of that. And all of that is true, that all those things do happen. And I think that's attractive to a lot of people. I think there's also just, like I mentioned, you know, the spiritual but not religious, it's kind of a respectable philosophical and experiential spirituality that it's very welcome in a post-Christian world where, you know, I guess I'm not exactly sure what about Christianity is so disapproved in our Western culture right now. But, you know, if I could speculate, I mean, things like, you know, God telling us this is true, this is false. God telling us in his scriptures, this is good to do, this is evil to do. And I think that, I think Buddhism really is able to sidestep a lot of that. And Buddhism was notoriously able to avoid extremes, say, well, we're not that, but we're also not that. And so kind of refusing to take a solid position on a lot of philosophical questions. And so all that to say, there's just a lot in Buddhism, whether it be the philosophy of Buddhism or the experience, the technique, that's just very attractive to people. And especially the idea that I can save myself through technique. It's very different from I need to put all my trust in God. It's a very humbling stance. Whereas if it's all about meditative technique, that kind of, it allows me to feel pretty good about myself.
So how does that differ from Christianity and its view of why people exist?
Yeah, well, you know, let me go back to Buddhism for just a moment, because this will really be able to accentuate the contrast, I think. The Buddhist view of creation is very, very different from the Christian view of creation. Christianity, God created the heavens and the earth, showed a special interest in creating humans for a particular purpose. When you go to Buddhism, their creation narrative is more philosophical, and it basically goes like this. Everything exists in dependence on everything else that exists. That's a real oversimplification, but it's called dependent co-arising. Dependent co-arising. Everything arises in dependence with everything else. And so they've put together, and this goes all the way back, you know, to the Buddha, but they, you know, these 12 steps that everything, all the way from ignorance — ignorance is actually the root cause of everything — ignorance all the way to the 12th step, which is aging and death, and everything in between, whether it be craving or feeling or what we sense in the world, all of these, you know, 12 factors rise and fall together. And so, you know, in that, you just see it's almost like none of that's really supposed to be there. There's no purposefulness behind it. It's almost like it's kind of accidentally there, shouldn't be there. And none of the things in the 12 steps are attractive, you know, everything from ignorance to aging and death. And so Christianity, on the other hand, there's just an incredible amount of purpose there. You know, then God said, "Let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock, over all the wild animals." You know, God created us very intentionally to bear his image, to reflect his glory, to rule his creation. And you just don't have anything like that in Buddhism in terms of why we exist. It really feels almost accidental and very negative, the fact that we exist at all within a Buddhist framework.
So what do you think would attract people to Buddhism's view of, you know, having this ultimate purpose that's really purposeless? What's attractive about that? And then what would make it maybe not a good thing for people to consider? I mean, I think what you're saying is Buddhism is a religion for people who aren't religious. And so usually when people are looking to religion for something, it's for purpose. So it seems antithetical to that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'd say what's really attractive is they're just not setting themselves up for disappointment. You know, there are people that have been, you know, just feel scammed by life on every side. And I think Buddhism's very attractive in being very realistic, saying, hey, it's all going to let you down at some level. And I would think if I were a Buddhist, I would see Christians as, man, they're going to have the greatest suffering because they're putting so much of their hope on something outside of, you know, themselves, that is something that, you know, could let them down, and that'd be on God. Now, as a Christian, I believe that, you know, we can put all our trust in God. That's the one person we can trust. But I do think that it's very attractive that they don't see themselves setting themselves up for disappointment. The Buddha even saw something as marvelous as a baby's birth as suffering. He said this is a quote. He says, "Birth is dukkha," which is suffering, futility. "Birth is, aging is, death is," on and on. Basically, he says all of life is dukkha, or is suffering. And when you've got that worldview, you are well fortified against any kind of disappointment. Now, I will say what would make that unattractive. You know, Holocaust survivor and psychiatrist Viktor Frankl, he talked about how suffering ceases to be suffering in some way at the moment it finds a meaning, such as the meaning of a sacrifice. And so, you know, in order to make it through suffering, and life has plenty of it, Frankl would say you've got to have purpose. Well, Buddhism not only says that all of life is suffering, but it also says there's no purpose. There's no ultimate purpose. And if you try to cling to an ultimate purpose, that's just going to cause you more suffering. That's why. So I'd say that's probably why it would be unattractive. But let me just say another thing. On the other side of the coin, some Buddhists will go so far, you know, into kind of an optimistic direction that they will paint this acceptance of our ultimate purposelessness, they'll paint that as a blissful thing. It's very counterintuitive, but basically within Buddhism, obviously you have kind of the original, the core, man, all of life is suffering and this is really tough and everything. But then you have some evolution there where by the time some of the Mahayana branches are philosophizing about this, they've actually turned the wheel of samsara, the wheel of rebirth, they've actually turned that into a good thing, because they say, hey, nirvana and samsara are the same thing. We can experience it right now. And this whole purposelessness, accepting of this purposelessness is a blissful thing. And so they'll say, hey, this freedom from attachment is also a freedom to create the world as you want it to be. There's this word that gets thrown around, thusness. There's this immediate thusness of everything, just this acceptance of everything as it is. There's no agenda. There's no hopes or dreams. It's just blissfully accepting everything as it is. And so you have even like the Catholic mystic Thomas Merton, who became friends with the Zen Buddhist D.T. Suzuki. And Merton was like, wow, I love this. And he was starting to merge Catholic and Buddhist practices. And he would play at what he would call deliberate irrelevance and what he would call beautiful purposelessness. So there is something attractive within at least a strand of Buddhism, something attractive about just accepting all of life as it is and just saying, no agenda, I'm just going to experience all of reality in its blissful thusness.
So I think there's a difference. I mean, one of the things you point out in the article is that there's a difference between that and Christianity. And Christianity, of course, is a religion that's full of purpose. And it has a completely different view of our ultimate purpose in life. So what is attractive about it? And I think you just noted what could seem unattractive to the Buddhist about it. But what is attractive about having an ultimate purpose?
Yeah, well, I mean, as a Christian, I look at what the Bible teaches about who I am and what I'm called to and why I was created and all that. And it's incredibly satisfying. And it's something I don't feel worthy of, but it is something we're all called to, you know, that we learn that we have a grand purpose in God's mind and that we can know our purpose and that it's an amazing purpose. And so we are given significance. And I would say this is very different from Buddhism and Hinduism. My one lifetime that I get is invested with eternal significance, huge significance. Whereas if this is just one birth among an infinite number, you know, then this really has my life has no significance. So I think there's something very attractive about that, just having a sense of grand purpose that we're called to, that we're created for. Just one more word on why it would be unattractive for some people. I would say, you know, there's such a high calling and purpose that we've been created for that it can be intimidating. You know, what Paul calls an eternal weight of glory in 2 Corinthians. C.S. Lewis, in his book called, you know, The Weight of Glory, he talked about how you have never talked to a mere mortal and how, you know, you look at the great civilizations and their life is a footnote compared, their life is like a gnat's life compared to, you know, human, you know, living a human living forever. And so he says that, you know, either we're turning into immortal horrors or everlasting splendors. And so there are days when it'd be nice just to be like, well, you know, a little bit less pressure just to be an animal, but we are humans and we have been invested with this grand purposefulness. And so it is a bit intimidating. So that's unattractive for some people.
So one thing that is a similarity between Buddhism and Christianity is how both religions actually take the problem of suffering very seriously. I mean, that suffering is a huge part of Buddhism. And both religions teach, of course, that suffering is real and that this life that we live is sometimes very challenging, sometimes very hard. And so there are those similarities between both of them. But where do Buddhism and Christianity, you know, fundamentally disagree about the issue of suffering and then also how to overcome suffering?
I'm going to tell two stories if I could. But before I do, I just want to give a shout out to a mentor of mine who has been the guy who, you know, really taught me about Buddhism and taught me of the importance of studying Buddhism. His name is Winfred Corduan, probably the greatest evangelical world religions expert alive today. And anyway, he told me this story. It goes, you know, back to the, the original canon. But he told me this story, and I found this story absolutely fascinating. So here's story number one, then I'll tell story number two. In the land of India lived a woman named Kisa. Now, Kisa had a son, an only son, who unexpectedly died. Now, Kisa could not accept that he was gone, so she scooped him up in her arms and went from neighbor to neighbor asking for medicine. Now, everybody knew, hey, medicine's not going to help. He's dead. But they would simply say, I'm sorry, I don't have the medicine that you need. Well, one neighbor suggested that Kisa go visit a religious teacher that was in the area. You know, perhaps the teacher can do something. So off she went to this teacher, and the teacher says, oh, I see. And we know of this teacher as the Buddha. Kisa, I know exactly what you need, he told her. What you need is a special seed. It's a mustard seed. And she's like, oh, well, I can go get a mustard seed. So, no, hang on. You need to get a mustard seed from a house which has never been touched by death. Okay, that's the mustard seed. If you can find, you need to find a mustard seed from a house that's never experienced death. And so she thanked him. She went off, still with the boy in her arms, to find this special seed. Well, of course, here we have a mustard seed. I'll go get one. No, wait. Has anyone in the household ever died? She would ask. Yes, as a matter of fact. Well, then thank you. Anyway, I need to find the seed from elsewhere. So Kisa goes from house to house. Everyone has a mustard seed for her, but there's not a single household that has been untouched by death. Death is everywhere. And then it hit her. Death is everywhere. That was the Buddha's point. That was the Buddha's special medicine. His medicine was for Kisa to understand that death is just what happens. Okay, that's story number one. Story number two, a woman loses her only son. And I'll just read it. Jesus went to a town called Nain, and his disciples and a large crowd went along with him. As he approached the town gate, a dead person was being carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow, and a large crowd from the town was with her. When the Lord saw her, his heart went out to her, and he said, don't cry. Now, so far, the two stories may sound a little similar. He's telling her, don't cry. The Buddha is trying to get her to, you know, be okay with it and to accept it. He says, don't cry. But here's where the story really takes a turn. Then he went up and touched the bier they were carrying him on, and the bearer stood still. He said, young man, I say to you, get up. The dead man sat up and began to talk, and Jesus gave him back to his mother. Luke chapter 7. See, when Jesus saw suffering and death, he didn't say, it's just the way things are. Why not? It's because Jesus knows better than anybody else that suffering and death are not the way things are supposed to be. Why is it that Jesus cried at the grave of his friend Lazarus when he was going to raise Lazarus within minutes? It's because Jesus knows better than anyone else how the world is really supposed to be. And so that's why Jesus turned funerals into parties. So both Buddhism and Christianity agree that suffering is very real and life can be very hard. Buddhism says it's just the way things are. Christianity says, yeah, but it's not the way things are supposed to be. In the name of Jesus, let's go and do something about it.
Well, I mean, I think this whole issue of suffering is a very big one. And sometimes it seems like this time of year, you know, towards the end of the year in December or at the beginning of a new year, people really feel a lot of like heaviness and sadness. And there's, you know, unfortunately, this time of year will bring about people committing suicide over those kinds of things. And so I think there's people that would agree and even Christians that would say, well, it would be nice to trust God, you know, and think that he's good even when life is really bad. But they still experience disappointment and heartache and challenge and suffering. And so it doesn't make sense. I mean, how can they trust in someone that might not turn their suffering in this present life to anything that is better, and that they just seem to go from one quote unquote bad thing to another? So do Christians have a good reason to step out in faith and trust in God, who we say is good, that goodness is part of his character, even when we as Christians experience what Buddhism actually teaches, that our lives are full of suffering. And I also, when you mentioned those two stories that Winfred Cordwin has written for our Christian Research Journal. So if people are interested in articles he's written for us, they're for free on our website, equip.org. So just go look up his name. But, you know, how can people really believe and trust in God, who the Bible says is good, when what they're experiencing in this broken world is one thing after another that tends to be what feels to them as unhappy or not good?
Yeah, do we have good reason to trust God even when life can just be, you know, suffering after suffering? You know, Buddhism teaches us to see emptiness in everything that we might cling to. You know, all the disappointments in life, according to Buddhism, are clues that there's no ultimate hope. So just stop looking. And like I said earlier, Buddhists have a point. Things rot. Leaders disappoint. The body wears out. Friends die. In Christianity, these episodes of emptiness are all seen as clues, but they're seen as clues training us to set our hearts on that which is eternal, that which is trustworthy, that which is true, that which is good. And to the question, you know, do we have good reason to invest our trust in God? I would just say, ironically, it's in emptiness that we find the strongest clue that there is something that we can ultimately trust. It's in the emptiness of a tomb near Jerusalem, a tomb that turned up empty, which tells me that all of that hope that Jesus was getting us to feel during his ministry, people's hearts coming alive and saying, I'm going to trust that there is a Heavenly Father that loves us. You know, all of that, you don't have to worry. You are forgiven. You are loved. All of that that Jesus was doing for us, the empty tomb tells me he was right. And that it makes all the sense in the world to put my trust in God. Even when I can't figure all these things out, I do know I can trust him because Jesus is alive.
Well, we might have someone who stumbled upon this podcast who is not a Christian, or maybe they're considering Christianity, but they themselves are just struggling with the notion of what we were just talking about. You know, how can a good God allow suffering, or how can bad things happen to what seems like good people? So what's an answer that would be helpful for a Christian perspective? Especially, we do have a lot of listeners that are, you know, a lay Christian apologist. What kind of answer could they give to somebody that they know that they've been talking to about Christianity who just really can't reconcile that? You're telling me that God is good, and yet I see all this suffering around me and suffering happens to me. So what's a helpful answer from a Christian perspective to that question?
Yeah, ultimately, you know, the best answer is experienced. You know, it's the presence of God. It's his ability to redeem the troubles. So I can give an answer that's helpful for me, and hopefully it'll be helpful for people who are listening. But ultimately, I do believe that this is the kind of thing that it needs to go beyond a kind of a logical, well, here's why it can make sense. But all that said, I'll offer this. Hopefully it's somewhat helpful. I would say in the tough times, you'll get your answer, I believe, if you allow yourself to be drawn to greater trust in him. I'm convinced that God is so trustworthy that he redeems even our worst sufferings. He takes our suffering and he makes something redemptive out of it. Just consider the good that God brings out of suffering. Even though we don't like it, we don't want it, and we're not asking for it, here are some of the things God brings out of suffering that are actually very good. So, you know, first, suffering helps us to hate evil. Without suffering, people could do just as much evil as they wanted, but they would never suffer the consequences. And so suffering does help us to hate evil, and hating evil is actually a really important place to be instead of loving evil. Secondly, I'd say suffering another way that God uses it for good. Suffering helps us to appreciate goodness. If we didn't suffer, everything good that happened to us, we would just expect. We would never really value it. I'd also say number three, suffering helps us know that we need God. And man, that's important. Suffering helps me to say, God, I need you. And if we never really knew how much we needed him, we would remain blissfully but hopelessly lost. I'd say fourthly, suffering helps us to grow. How do you grow in love? Do you grow as a loving person by always being around loving people? How do you grow in courage? Do you grow in courage by never having to face fearful situations? How do you grow in patience? Do you grow in patience by never, ever being inconvenienced? And I'd say also the suffering that we face, I know it's incredibly heavy and dark at times, but I will say this, the suffering that we face, it doesn't cancel out all of the evidence that we have that there is a God who created us. It doesn't cancel that out at all. There is a God who created us. And so let's give him the benefit of the doubt that suffering doesn't have the final say in all of this. I remember Os Guinness said something to the effect of, he said, you know, I don't know why the Holocaust, I don't know why cancer, but I do know why I trust in God who knows why. Again, he says, I don't know why this or this, but I do know why I trust in God who knows why. And so we can be okay leaving the answers in his hands. And when we do trust in God, even in suffering, that's when he uses it. And that's when we see that he uses it to bring about our good.
Well, finally, on a much lighter note, I have some fun rapid fire questions for Daniel. So Daniel, what is your favorite meal?
Oh, favorite meal? Man, my wife makes so many amazing ones. I'm just going to say spaghetti because that's like my default for the past few decades.
Introvert or extrovert?
Extrovert.
Early bird or night owl?
Both.
Well, that's, I guess a few people say that they're both early birds and night owls. You must not get very much sleep.
There you go.
Well, thank you, Daniel, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you so much. It's been a blast.
You've been listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest was Daniel J. McCoy. He has written an article for us on our website, equip.org. It's called, Why Do We Exist? Opposite Answers from Buddhism and Christianity. And this particular article is free for everyone to read at our website, equip.org. And of course, as I had mentioned before, Daniel has a new book coming out called Buddhism or Christianity, Which is Better for the World? And he will do a deep dive even more than we did during our discussion today on the podcast about this topic. And his book is being published by Moral Apologetics Press. Stay connected with the Christian Research Institute and all the new content we have coming your way. The best way to do that is to head on over to our website, equip.org. There you will find thousands of free resources right at your fingertips, from articles to video to audio, and it's all for free. You'll find our podcasts hosted there, as well as the Bible Answer Man broadcast, which is hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and streams live every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. In addition, you don't want to miss out on subscribing to Hank Unplugged, which is the podcast of Hank Hanegraaff. And in that podcast, he has really in-depth, free-flowing, essential Christian conversations with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people. And in addition, he has a new series on his podcast feed called Hank Unplugged Shorts, which Hank goes into the headlines in the mainstream media and refutes a lot of those cultural issues that we have in these short podcast episodes. And there's quite a few of them. You don't want to miss out on them. Now, if you want to find some of this at other places where it's all in one place, really subscribe to our YouTube channel. It's a great way to get all of our content there, our podcasts there, and different individual questions theologically that people have that Hank answers at our YouTube channel. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, I don't know how to subscribe to YouTube. I don't have a YouTube account.
Well, actually, you might just have a YouTube account. If you have a Gmail address, you have a YouTube account. Just log into YouTube with your Gmail address and search for Bible Answer Man channel, and please become one of our subscribers. In addition, if you see that bell icon right there on our front page, please click that. And every time that we have new content, you will receive a notification that new content is up on our channel for you to be able to consume. So thank you so much for the ways in which you partner with the Christian Research Institute. We are grateful for you listening and reading and watching.